We're going to call the meeting to order. So, anybody had an opportunity, Representative Slocum, have had an opportunity to look at the minutes? Are you willing to move them?
So moved.
Any questions with the minutes? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Minutes approved. Chair Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this is my maiden voyage this year before the Commerce and Labor Committee. I've heard great things about this committee, particularly about the Vice Chair, and I'm happy to be here to present House File 417. I would move House File 417 be recommended pass and be referred to the Committee on Civil Justice. There are a couple of author's amendments that you should have in your packets. Those are author's amendments. One is from Mr. Pender. I believe that is the A1 amendment that was just cleaning up some language.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And I would move the A1 amendment, and then I'll talk about the A2 amendment in a moment.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Atkins. Everybody have a copy of the A1 amendment? Should be in your stuff. It's pretty short. Any questions regards A1? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? A1 adopted. We have another amendment, sir?
We do, Mr. Chair. A2 is some of the folks in the insurance industry raised the question about whether or not certain language, the fashion in which it applied, was kind of newfangled language that they were uncomfortable with, so we went back to some language that's been in use for about, I think, since the Magna Carta or whenever. So it's language that there's more comfort with, and we wanted to try to do our best to give them some level of comfort with the language in the bill. That also is an author's amendment that will put it in the shape in which I'd like to proceed with it, and I'll move the A2 amendment.
Thank you, Chair Atkins. Everybody have a copy of the A2 amendment? Any questions? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? That's passed. Chair Atkins, we have House File 417 before us as amended. And go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I will be fairly brief in giving you an overview of the bill because we've got some very good witnesses here to testify with respect to it. But essentially what House File 417 does is was brought to me by a group of business folks called the Minnesota Business Policy Holder Coalition. It is businesses, small, large, that's not my cell phone, I left it up in the office, but it's small, mid, and large-sized businesses across the state of Minnesota, ranging in size from as few as 4 employees up to, I believe, a couple of companies that have 12,000 or more employees. What it does, in fact, what I thought I'd do hopefully not causing heartburn for Representative Murdoch, but is give an example of how it would apply. And I thought, who's a good small business person on our committee? And I know what we've got. Representative Murdoch has a hardware store. I think it's an Ace Hardware store back home. Is that right? The way that this bill applies is if he went home on Friday and, heaven forbid, found his store had been burnt down, all the product was gone, he has insurance that he's probably, I assume he got insurance, right, Mr. Murdoch? He's been paying for years and years for insurance on this place. It burns down, the product's all gone. He goes to his insurance company and he says, I've got, let's say it's $2 million between the business and all the stuff inside of it. And he just wants to have his insurance policy kick in and pay that $2 million. If they pay, this bill doesn't even go into effect. If they just pay the coverage for which he's been paying premiums for, there's no impact at all. Unfortunately, what happens more and more often is that folks won't get paid, and they'll go through sometimes a year or two or three or four where they're not getting paid. As you can imagine, if you're a little hardware store owner your place is burnt down, now what do you do? Well, you have to go down and find the lawyer to bring that claim against the insurance company just to get you the coverage that you were already paying to have. And that lawyer costs some money. And in addition to that, you probably got to go to the bank and get a loan so you can get your store operating again. During that period of time, now you're paying a mortgage on the place that burned down. You're paying back your loan on the new place, you got all these bills coming. And at the end of the day, you make your claim for $2 million. The insurance company maybe has been offering nothing, or they've been offering $500,000 or $700,000 or some too low of an offer. You go through all the litigation. At the end of the day, you prevail. You get $2 million. And what happens is you've got a lawyer bill that's $700,000 or $800,000 that you got to pay, and you got this loan that you had to go to the bank and get to start up a new operation so you could keep your business going. When you figure out the math on that, you got your entire policy payment back, the $2 million. Now you subtract out what you pay the lawyers, you subtract out the loans and everything, and you're not made whole. Not by any stretch of the imagination. So in spite of the fact that you paid all this money for insurance, at the end of the day, you got about half of what you probably should have had they just paid at the outset. All this bill does is say if you prevail, then you get to be paid whatever attorney's fees you had. It's not a trial lawyer bill. You may have gotten some emails during the course of the day-to-day because the trial lawyer guy gets paid no matter what. Mr. Murdoch, the hardware store owner, would have to pay that lawyer one way or another. This just gets Mr. Murdoch paid back, the owner of the store, if he prevails. The insurance companies already have this. If you bring a frivolous claim or a fraudulent claim, they can get their attorney's fees from that business. You just can't get yours from them. In fact, you can actually be criminally charged if you bring a false claim in Minnesota or a fraudulent claim in Minnesota. So right now the cards are stacked in favor of the insurance company. This just tries to make folks whole and put them on a little bit more level footing. With that, I've got some people here that will tell you some nightmares that they've experienced just trying to get the coverage that they had been paying for years and years to have on their companies. And when they experienced a tragic event, they weren't in good hands and didn't get treated very well, and they're just trying to be made whole. We've got four folks, Liz Porter, Ann Archambault, Dale Johnson, and Tom Mielenhausen, is that cleanup. Thank you very much for coming.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, here,
my name is Dale Johnson.
Okay, thank you.
I spent 11 years as the CFO of Angion Corporation. Angion currently builds cardiopulmonary diagnostic systems that they sell to customers around the world. The revenue currently is roughly $30 million a year, and they currently employ approximately 120 employees. During my time there, we experienced a claim from one of our customers for a product that we used to sell. That was in the summer of 2003. We filed the claim immediately with our insurance company. 14 months later, the insurance company came back and said, "You don't have coverage." 14 months after they led us to believe in correspondence that we had coverage. That was in September 2004. In the summer of 2005, the claimant basically forced us to settle the claim. And we had to do so. It hurt the company badly because we had to do so with our own resources. But we did settle the claim. And a few months later, in August of 2005, the court finally came back and said that the insurance company did have a duty to defend us, Angion Corporation. And not only that, but the insurance company breached its duty to defend us. So here we are. They were late in 14 months to take us to court. We didn't go to court. They did. And the court finally upheld the contract. After what I view as a very significant victory in court, they still didn't negotiate with us. It drug on until the court decision was August 2005. It went into February of 2006. When we finally got another opinion from the court that was generally favorable, but they left a couple of things hanging. In the long term, the claim was about $2 million. We settled it by ourselves. We did reach a confidential settlement with the insurance company that took until, it wasn't done until April of 2006. So unfortunately, nearly 3 years after the claim was filed, the insurance company finally paid Angion Corporation. This thing hurt the company in several ways. One, Angion's publicly traded, so we had to report all of this to the public, and have this very big uncertainty on our balance sheet. Do we have insurance? Do we not have insurance? What's the claim going to ultimately be settled for? That hurt the value of the company. We had to prematurely settle the claim with our customer, using our own resources to do that. And not only that, but the time and the labor of all of this wore on the staff and so on and so forth. At the end of the day, the company did not recover its legal fees. We basically got paid for some of the claims. Having finished that, having left the Angion Corporation a little over a year ago, I'm currently engaged in a consulting arrangement with another company by the name of North Star Beef, located in Buffalo Lake, Minnesota. Guess what? They have a problem too. They had a fire last summer, and they had been in the process of expanding their plant to do some new operations and expand their operation, and one of the subcontractors started a fire. So there's a property damage claim and there's a business interruption claim, and this insurance company is also dragging their feet, not demonstrating any willingness whatsoever to negotiate. And I might add that that insurance company is one of our own. They're based in Minnesota. With that, I'd be happy to take questions.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. I think what we're going to do is kind of continue through the group there and then maybe take questions a little bit later, if that's okay. So stick around. Please say your name for the record and go ahead when you're ready, please.
My name is Anna Shamble, and Mr. Chairman and members. I'm here to represent ABC Companies. Just a little brief history about ABC. We're approximately 30 years old, family-owned and operated, private corporation, based in Faribault, Minnesota, approximately 20,000 people. We employ about 100 people in Faribault, and we're in the business of selling, servicing, leasing, financing motor coaches, like Greyhound, very large highway coaches. As you can see in the transportation arena, insurance is the number one aspect that is the most important thing to ABC, our customers, the riding public, and everybody who uses transportation needs insurance. One demonstrative example is currently we have two motor coaches, very large value, completely damaged, and we're out approximately $400,000. Claims, property damage claims, have been wrongly denied. We can't put our services, we can't fix them, we don't want to put any more money into them. So we're sitting with two coaches and we're unable to do anything with them. That's just an example, one small example. I deal with all these things on a monthly basis. Over the last 9 years that I've been with ABC, I can say that there's been multiple separate instances like this one, and either claims are wrongly denied or significantly delayed, and ABC is left having to pick up the pieces. And the only thing ABC can do is file some type of court action to get the attention of the insurance company so that they can properly adjust our claims. Now, what also happens is that when we're in a court action, ABC is not only incurring significant expenses on the underlying action that may be occurring, but also we're incurring significant expenses in the lawsuits against the insurance company. We spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on both levels. We're a mid-sized company, and we can't sustain those types of expenses for any extended period of time. So this is very detrimental to a company of ABC's size and stature. What ABC would rather be doing with this money is, of course, spending it for the company, to grow the company, and to make ABC as good and as great as a company as I know it is. At the end of the day, ABC, there's a lot of people that depend on ABC, customers, riding public, and its employees. This bill, in my opinion, and in the opinion of ABC, would ensure that ABC is not left holding the bill, and we can be made whole, fully and completely whole, and we can focus on doing what we should be doing, that's operating a successful business. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Please state your name for the record.
Liz Porter from St. Jude Medical.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm an employee of St. Jude Medical. As you might know, that's a medical device manufacturer. We have our global headquarters in St. Paul. We employ roughly 2,200 people in the Twin Cities. We make products to treat cardiac-related conditions and chronic pain. The focus and passion of the employees at St. Jude Medical is to develop life-saving products. Despite strenuous and continued efforts we make to make the best product, there's an inherent risk in our industry. Due to the litigation climate in the U.S. as well, we've purchased commercial liability insurance. Year after year, we've paid significant premiums to the insurance companies to get this coverage. We expect that our carriers will be there for us if we encounter a loss, but this has not been our experience. We have been sued by insurance carriers three times since 1996, and we currently have two suits that are ongoing. In the first case, St. Jude Medical was sued on two class actions. We notified our carrier promptly. We cooperated with them. We shared information. We sought coverage, and the carrier instigated a 13-month coverage investigation. After 13 months, the carrier denied coverage, was unwilling to compromise, and then brought suit against St. Jude Medical. That suit has now been pending for over a year and a half. The carrier has made burdensome and unnecessary discovery demands, the only purpose being to drive up attorney's fees and to delay the litigation, to delay the payment of the claim. They have no incentive to settle. This has been a huge drain on company resources, including very important quality assurance employees and product development employees that have given lots of time and effort and been unnecessarily dragged into this litigation. In the second case, which is currently pending as well, we had a product recall in 2000. It was a very conservative move by the company in the interest of patient safety. Again, we notified our carrier, cooperated, shared information on a regular basis. The first layers of coverage paid the loss. The sixth layer of coverage with a follow form policy flatly refused their coverage of $50 million and sued St. Jude Medical. We've now been forced to pay all our indemnity and defense costs. Again, we're getting discovery from the carrier, unnecessary, burdensome. They're trying to relitigate the underlying claim, which is 8 years of litigation. Again, the only purpose is running up attorney's fees, and the carrier is still holding on to our insurance proceeds, $50 million. They make a lot of money off that float. So, in sum, I would urge your support of this bill. Even if we succeed in our coverage dispute, we are still not recovering attorney's fees, lost interest, and a huge lost productivity of our employees. The insurance companies have no incentive to come to the table and settle. It's a serious problem for our company. We want to be out there making great products that save people's lives, save lives of people in this room and family members. So I would also like to add that this has ripple effects for Minnesota. I think that the patients in Minnesota, as well as the creation and retention of jobs here. So I would urge your support of the bill.
Thank you, Ms. Porter. Please state your name and go ahead when you're ready, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tom Millenhausen, and I'm an attorney at the Lindquist & Venom firm in Minneapolis. I have more than 20 years of experience in dealing in this specific area. I represent business policyholders exclusively when they encounter delays or denials of coverage. What you just heard are not isolated problems. This is a persistent problem that I have seen over the last two decades in this state. We have the least amount of remedies available to business policyholders in the state of Minnesota when compared to the rest of the country. And as a result, what you get is exactly what you heard. The problem out there is that insurance companies in Minnesota, property casualty companies, have no financial incentive to settle claims before they choose to. And the second problem is they have the ability to leverage their business policy holders by causing them to incur substantial attorney's fees that end up cutting into the actual recovery and insurance proceeds. And they use that leverage in order to try to get the lowest settlement that they can. This insurance legislation that you see before you, what we call the Policyholder Protection Act, just does two very simple and straightforward things. Number one, it imposes, in the event that the policyholder prevails, it imposes a higher prejudgment interest rate of 12% on the proceeds that were due under the policy. The second thing that it does is it allows the policyholder to recover its reasonable and only its reasonable attorney's fees that it incurred in establishing coverage. These remedies are available to the business policyholder. It only applies to commercial insurance, and it's only available if the policyholder prevails. Now, the purpose of this legislation is not to punish the insurance companies. We're not really, unlike the trial attorneys, the businesses just really aren't interested in dealing with litigation over the insurance company's conduct or their motives or anything like that. It's just a simple economic calculus. We want to level the playing field so that the insurers have a financial incentive to settle, and that when they try to leverage the policyholder by causing them fees, they think twice because they may end up having to pay for that. The purpose of this legislation is simply to make the business policyholder whole, to decrease delay in the settlement of coverage claims, to reduce leverage against business policyholders, particularly small businesses, and all of this, the way the legislation is designed, is to do it without increasing court burden or litigation. And the reason for that is because when you get into standards that you see with punitive damages, tort damages, the type of bad faith legislation around the country that is conduct-based, that ends up increasing litigation costs substantially. The last thing the business wants to do is have to get into a whole other piece of litigation over the insurance company's motives. It's real simple. If the policyholder prevails, it gets these remedies. Now, you're going to hear several arguments from the insurance industry, the Insurance Federation, opposing this. The first thing they're going to tell you is that this is a wild, extreme, radical remedy. I'm telling you, it's not true. We have given Representative Atkins, and I'm sure he'll share this with you if you'd like to get into the details, a 50-state survey of the law around the country. Now, states, in addressing this situation, have a whole panoply of remedies out there. What we have done is we have picked two very conservative remedies. And I'll talk about each of those. First of all, the prejudgment interest. 22 states out there allow a policyholder to recover prejudgment interest at a rate of 10% or higher. 11 of them allow 12% or higher. And all the policyholder has to do to recover this is just simply to prevail. Secondly, on attorney's fees, 46 states allow fees when the policyholder prevails. 21 of those, the policyholder need only show that it prevailed. The other 25 gets into these conduct-based standards that I talked about that, in our view, is unnecessary and increases litigation. So this is not outside the legal mainstream. Also, I should mention that on the prejudgment interest, we already have a precedent for that in Minnesota. It's in the no-fault statute. If a no-fault insurer does not pay within, I believe it's either 30 or 60 days, pay the benefits that are due, they have to pay 15% interest on that. 15%, not the 4% or around that neighborhood of prejudgment interest. And that is a standard that does not rely in any way, shape, or form on the conduct of the carrier. It's just simply if they don't pay in time, this is the interest rate that's charged. We've also heard that the Insurance Federation, insurance lobby, undoubtedly will say that there's a damages provision in here that allows.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Davis.
To that point, to Mr. Mielenhausen, shouldn't we let the Insurance Federation testify for the Insurance Federation? I always have a problem when somebody comes in and tells me what the other guy's going to say. Why don't we let them say it?
Mr. Chair, yes, I will. Thank you, Mr. Representative. This will not result in a raise in premiums. We have asked, actually, the Insurance Federation for evidence that indeed, you know, remedies like this have resulted in a raise in premiums in other states. We asked for that about 8 weeks ago. They have not given that to us. What we did receive from them was information from the state of West Virginia, but that information actually supports our position, not theirs. In 2005, West Virginia repealed third-party bad faith. After that, according to this report, premiums went down in that state. But what the Insurance Federation doesn't or neglects to mention is that when premiums went down in that state, there was a remedy in place, and the remedy in place was the first-party attorney's fees remedy that we're talking about here. By the Insurance Federation's own admission, premiums went down with that remedy in place. This is not bad for small business. It's actually the small businesses that will
go ahead and kind of try to wrap up pretty quick here.
Yes,
sir.
We'll do. Finally, I would just say that this is a real and serious remedy, a real and serious problem. We have tried to tailor the remedy to be reasonable. We've actually even proposed amendments to Representative Atkins in order to meet some of the concerns of the Insurance Federation, and I will hope that you will give this fair reading of the merits. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Stick around. Might have some questions for you. Chair Atkins, any comments before we have some...
And Mr. Chair, rather than even go into questions or anything, I'd just like to give the other side an opportunity to be heard, and then to the extent there's questions afterwards, we'll take them.
Sounds great, Chair Atkins. Mr. Johnson, looks like you're... Please come forward, and Bev, I don't know if you want to... Oh, you're there. Okay, great. Okay, and Marcus, and then...
We're gonna get it.
I don't know how what you've got in mind, but go ahead and present as... say your name and go ahead and when you're ready, sorry.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Beverly Turner, and I work for Travelers Insurance Company. Travelers is the largest property casualty insurance company that's domiciled here in Minnesota. Our corporate headquarters is located in downtown St. Paul, and we do employ a significant number of Minnesotans and jobs in the state. We strongly oppose this legislation and respectfully ask for your no vote on its passage. Simply put, increasing insurance litigation costs is going to increase insurance premiums. And particularly in these hard economic times, this is simply something you do not want to do to your small businesses here in Minnesota. I'd like to address some of the things that have been stated in support of the bill based on travelers' experience in this area. First of all, we do not delay payments in order to invest money to make more money. It simply does not happen. In fact, what we have found from our claims data is that the longer that we delay a payment claim is not resolved, the more we end up paying. So we actually are financially incented that we have found to make our payments promptly and resolve matters in a prompt fashion. I also want to take a quote from our 2007 annual report, which states, because the primary purpose of the investment portfolio is to fund claims payments, the company employs a conservative investment philosophy. So the characterization that we are making a lot of money off the float simply isn't true. It's just the opposite. We're using those investments to actually help to pay our claims. Another point I'd like to make is that over the past 3 years prior to 2008, because we do have a conservative investment philosophy, our return on investment has been less than 4%, which is at the rate of prejudgment interest now is 4%. It's ranged from 3.7 to 3.9% in years, the 3 years prior to 2008, which, so there is no float. It's actually less than the amount of prejudgment interest that's currently in place at 4%. I also wanted to address the contention that this legislation is in keeping with other states and that it's not extreme. I would respectfully disagree with that, and I have a story to tell you about that. We've been asked, and one of the witnesses did indicate, we've been asked to provide some data on the cost impact of this legislation. Well, as you can imagine, Travelers is a very large company. We have a lot of folks that spend a lot of time in these areas. Actuaries, our claims people, our filing program people, who all devote a lot of time and energy to figuring these things out, more than I ever could. They came back to me and said, we're sorry, we can't give you a cost impact on this legislation because no other state goes as far as this legislation goes. So we simply can't judge how much this is going to impact. We know it is going to, but we simply can't help you with your arguments before the committee on cost impact because it goes so far compared to other states. And that's what we have to rely on when we do our cost estimate of other legislation that's been passed in states to determine a cost impact. I would state that I'm sure the author does not want unintended consequences of increasing premiums on small businesses, but from what we understand of the bill, this is certainly what is going to happen. And I also want to state that there are times when we do have legitimate concerns over coverage disputes where we have to do our due diligence to get to the bottom of how much we owe a policyholder and resolve the various disputes and coverage. And we do that for due diligence purposes for all our policyholders so that they're all treated fairly when there are claims before us. But we do also have before us claims that we do promptly pay and do our due diligence on and hopefully have our happy customers because, again, we are a large company in this state and we are very proud of our name and our track record. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Turner. Mr. Marsh, please say your name and go ahead when you're ready. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm just going to have just a very short statement. First of all, we do appreciate the language in the bill that exempts our township mutuals under 67A. But I need to make clear that our current membership, we have 86 township mutuals under 67A, again, which this exemption applies. We have 9 companies who have left 67A and are now under Chapter 66, which this proposal and last year's bad faith do apply. We also have 6 larger companies in which we also buy our reinsurance and package with and are also direct competitors of ours. And again, this legislation as well as last year's bad faith do apply. With that in mind, our board of directors feels that with the compromise that was passed last year in bad faith, or good faith, whichever way you want to describe it, depends on whose perspective, last year was my 12th session for our association, and bad faith or good faith has been around every year. And the feeling of our board is that there finally was this compromise. And so this legislation is not needed at this time. What we instead need to do is monitor last year's legislation and see, once we develop a history, if something else needs to happen. And so therefore, our board of directors has taken a position of opposition to this bill. And I might note just one other thing, and I think it might get into this comment with some of the related issues. But if there's a problem with our companies, I don't know what people do about talking to the Department of Commerce or other regulators, but we get leaned on really quick if there's any particular issue. So I just wanted to also mention that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Marsh. Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. It's a trade association representing a lot of Minnesota companies and other companies doing business in the state. So I'll not be repetitive, Mr. Chairman and committee members, just a couple of key points. And we do oppose House Bill 417 and urge the committee to vote no on the bill. Just a little bit of background, I would like to refresh the committee. Well, before that, maybe what I'd like to say is that having testified up here for a lot of years, we're at a decided disadvantage when an individual business comes to the table and gives a part of the story, their side of the story, to you all as a committee that we did wrong on a claim file. We'd like to bring the claim file to the table and be able to present it to the committee and let you decide, or at least have an opportunity. So I just ask the committee to consider, because through the years and on other bills, when individuals have come to this podium or any other podium and alleged wrongdoing on the part of some insurance company, when we've had an opportunity to present both sides, it hasn't always come out that it was what you heard wasn't the full story. And I'm not saying the three individuals, because I don't know what the other side of the story, but there is another side of the story. And when carriers deny claims or make a decision, there's usually a reason for that. It's unfortunate that we have the situation where hearings come and a business says, I got hosed and they didn't pay something. A lot of times it wasn't paid because it wasn't supposed to be paid, or it contractually wasn't covered, or it was a claim that should have been denied. And all I'll tell the committee is that in another time I can present you evidence that documents that that's exactly the case. That's what happened at the legislature, in this building and in the state capitol, with businesses presenting wrongs. And before that legislative session was over, that the business wrong proved to not be wrong. It was the right decision to not pay the claim. And Mr. Chairman, it's just unfortunate. We don't have the benefit of it. I cannot comment. And it's too bad that that's the way this is going to play out. But I would just urge the committee, if we're going to lay this on the table, then let's lay it on the table. Give us the shot. Let the business give permission to bring the case to the table, and we'll present the other side of the case. So it's just what we have to deal with, Mr. Chairman. I realize that that's life, but it isn't the best situation, because you don't have the benefit of knowing what fully happened in that claim file, and there's a lot more to it. With that, Mr. Chairman, I think just briefly, the legislature of the Minnesota House actually did consider this bill in substantially similar form on March 27th of 2008 on the floor of the Minnesota House, when Representative Smith and Chairman Atkins brought a Delete Everything amendment before the Minnesota House on the 2008 Good Faith, Bad Faith bill. And there was a lengthy debate in that Delete Everything amendment. The last section of it basically was the same as House File 417. So the full House on that day in 2008 debated for over 2 hours this bill, and there was a lot of shuffling and a lot of comments and notes being sent in. A floor amendment was actually offered by Representative Zellers to delete that section of the bill, and the section was deleted by the full House on an 80-52 vote after a two-hour debate. So this is actually not a brand new issue that the Minnesota House has not considered, and all of the remedy elements that are in 417, the same remedy elements were in that floor amendment and in that deleted section. So just a little bit of history on that. But with that, Mr. Chairman and committee members, I think from the industry's perspective, you have heard the reason for this bill is being stated that we're sitting on claims to make money on the float. That's kind of the essence of it. And the evidence is not there to show that. You've heard Bev Turner from Travelers. I can bring into you, and you can verify with the Commerce Commissioner, what are the investment yields of property casualty companies. And what the data will show you is that 75% of their money is put in bonds. Solid block of money. You're not reading much about property casualty companies in the current investment company crisis cycle, in large part because of the conservative investments, but the investment yields are considerably lower than what some proponents are saying that we're making on the float. So the actual numbers prove that to be incorrect. It's just flat not right. And so, you know, we presented some evidence of that. And I think that premise is cannot be proven. I think secondly, and we're not going to be able to get into it here, Mr. Chairman. I think as some of the proponents have said about what happens around the rest of the country, and we've gone through this before, but there's a number of 50 state charts you should all look at. And so we'll make sure that if you've got a set, we'll make sure you have another set. Here's the thing that I'll tell you. It's not just us, and I guess I'd ask the committee to consider. Other groups are looking at this legislation, other national groups like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the Institute for Legal Reform. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce Institute for Legal Reform is opposed to this bill. The American Tort Reform Association is opposed to this bill. There are national players that are looking at this and are describing this bill as a fringe remedy compared to the rest of the 50 states. And so this is documentation that they put together, and I would urge the committee, it gets a little lengthy, we're not going to be able to do it here, but you can read it. And you should read the documentation where other national groups, other Minnesota business groups, the National Federation of Independent Business, I know, that surveyed their members, and by a 3-to-1 margin amongst the members, 13,000 small employers opposed this bill. So there are other employers who don't view this as a good remedy for the businesses in the state. So, Mr. Chairman, we think that the law that was passed in 2008 that creates a new consumer remedy that gives individuals who have had a claim denied, if a standard of conduct is triggered by the insurer, to get the up to $100,000 attorney fees and the up to $250,000, should be permitted to work, and we shouldn't staff. This bill, if passed, actually contradicts staff on top of the 2008 law. If a commercial property owner has a denied claim, they have the right under the 2008 law. They also would have the right to the remedy under House File 417, and they're not the same remedy. Which remedy is going to apply? A business interruption claim is subject to the 2008 law. It would also be subject to House File 417. Which remedy is going to apply? They don't read the same. So I think there's some contradictory issues that on a going forward basis that would need to be dealt with. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I thank you for the time. We oppose the bill. We urge you to vote no on it.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. We have a couple members that have on a list here that were for questions, but we're going to wait on that. We're going to let you go, and then we'll have some questions. So go ahead and please state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chuck Stevak for the record. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm an attorney in private practice in Minneapolis. I'm a partner in the law firm Marin Gear. I practice principally in the area of insurance coverage litigation, and my clients are almost exclusively insurance companies. I've been doing this for 29 years. I'm co-chair of the Minnesota Defense Lawyers Association Insurance Law Committee, and I'm appearing today speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Defense Lawyers Association's Law Improvement Committee. I bring an interesting perspective to this discussion because we talk about how Minnesota stacks up compared to other states in this regard. I've been fortunate over the 29 years of my practice to have had a practice that's national in scope. And over the course of my practice, in addition to practicing in Minnesota, I've litigated insurance coverage cases in 26 other foreign jurisdictions. In fact, at this very moment, I have cases pending in 7 other states besides Minnesota. Next week, at this time, I'll be in federal court in Massachusetts, arguing an insurance coverage case under Massachusetts law in the Massachusetts courts. I bring that up not as a means of self-aggrandizement, but to give a personal experience and imprimatur on what Mr. Johnson is telling you and what these national organizations are telling you, and that is, if this bill is passed as written, it will put Minnesota out on its own in terms of the extent of the remedies against insurance companies for the otherwise good faith contesting of rights due under a contract and the penalties that will be imposed upon insurance companies in Minnesota. There's nothing like this in terms of the totality of the remedy that this bill contains and the lack of proof necessary in order to impose these remedies in any other jurisdictions in which I've been fortunate to practice. Now, I understand and agree that these penalties, and I'm going to get to a minute as to why I call them penalties, are asserted only if the insurer loses its coverage litigation. But a loss in the courts doesn't mean that the claims were asserted without a good faith basis to assert their validity, and no party to any contract should be penalized for asserting their rights under a contract in good faith. Now, I'm not talking about those isolated horror stories that we hear where, for example, people engage in vexatious discovery or where people unreasonably deny claims. There are remedies for that. If someone's serving duplicitous discovery, the rules of evidence and the rules of discovery say you're not allowed to do that. Get the judge to tell you that you're serving duplicitous discovery and you shouldn't be allowed to do it. If you've got a claim that has no merit as a matter of law, Rule 56, summary judgment, has been on the books since 100 years before I became a practicing lawyer. It's a case dismissed as a matter of law. But what this bill deals with is not vexatious conduct. It deals simply with the situation of where an insurance company has a good faith basis to believe that there are either no benefits due under a contract or some dispute as to the amount of benefits due under a contract and choose to litigate it. And if they lose, they're penalized. Now, how are they penalized? They're penalized by being forced to pay a prejudgment interest rate that's higher than what any other business person to any other contract has to pay. If the prejudgment interest rate as set by the legislature isn't high enough to represent the lost use of the money during the period of dependency during which it hasn't been paid, then raise it for everybody. But to raise it just for the insurance companies, but to leave everyone else the same, to me is nothing more than penalizing the insurance companies for exercising their rights under contract where other people to contracts aren't faced with the same penalty. The same goes true with the deviation of what you've heard called the American rule with regard to who pays attorney's fees in litigation. The American rule is that each party pays their own attorney's fees. There are very limited exceptions to that. There's already an exception in the insurance context flowing from the nature of the contract itself that says that the losing party has to pay attorney's fees to a policyholder if they succeed in establishing that the insurance company breached its duty to defend, because the contract contains a defense requirement, and so defense costs, the attorney's fees are deemed to be a damage that flows from the contract. But in this circumstance, we're saying that if an insurance company, in good faith, asserts right under an insurance policy and loses, this becomes an exception to all other bodies of contract law where the American rule isn't followed and the insurance company, the loser, has to pay. Now, you've heard examples from other people who have testified as to why this bill is necessary. Let me give you an example where the application of this bill would work in extreme injustice as written. In the early 1980s, we were dealing with the cost of how to clean up environmental contamination. And the Minnesota courts decided that in some of these environmental contamination cases where the contamination has been in place for a number of years, in some cases hundreds of years, going back to the 1800s, we're going to allow every insurance policy that's on the risk during that maybe 100-year period to be implicated and have to reimburse its policyholder for the cost that it faces today for cleaning up those environmental risks. In the early 1990s, one of the issues that flowed out of that rule of law was, all right, how do you allocate those costs between these various insurance companies that are on the risk? You have 50 years of contamination, 50 different insurance companies. How do you allocate as to what they're supposed to pay? And I was involved in a case involving the big local utility, Northern States Power Company. I represented the St. Paul Fire Marine, where that issue was brought to the forefront. The utility's position was, we should be able to pick any one insurance company during that 50-year period and have them pay 100% of it. The damage may have been caused over 50 years, but we'll make 1 year of insurance pay for 100% of it. My client's position was, it needs to be allocated in some fashion. We litigated this issue. I won at the trial court. Judgment was entered in my client's favor saying I owed nothing. It went to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals reversed, saying that the legal principle that I won on, we're not going to accept. We're going to send it back to the trial court for more development of evidence to see how we're going to allocate these damages over this 100 years worth of insurance. Before that could happen, the Supreme Court decided we want to weigh in on this. This is an important issue. We want to weigh in on it. The Supreme Court weighed in on it and announced a rule that was deemed a landmark decision nationwide at the time and said that we're going to allocate this damage between the insurers' companies pro rata according to the time they're on the risk. So if you have 1 year out of the 50 years, you pay 1/50. If you have 5 years out of the 50 years, you pay 10th, and so on and so on. This was viewed to be a major win for the insurance interest because this was the position they were advocating as to how fairness in the policy language required this loss to be allocated. And in fact, it's part of the reason why I practice in all 50 states. My reputation was made by this case, and insurance companies now started to come to me, wanting to have me practice in other places. But what ended up happening at the end of the day? At the end of the day, now that the Supreme Court had set the rules, we sat down with NSC's counsel, We did the math, and we figured out of the $1.6 million total they asked us to pay at the beginning, we owed less than $200,000 of it. We agreed to what the amount was, we wrote a check, and the case was over. Now, under this bill, the way it's currently written, no one would begin to say that my company took a position that was vexatious, that caused NST to be delayed in getting its result, that my argument was in bad faith. In fact, I made law that is now cited in all 50 states in terms of how this should be done, or the cases that rejected it say how it shouldn't be done. At least it's recognized as a seminal case on this issue. But at the end of the day, I would have had to have had a judgment entered against my client had we not agreed to all this for about $160,000. Under this bill, I would have been the loser. And I, company, would have had to have paid 100% of every penny of attorney's fees that NST incurred in litigating this issue, where both of us were arguing in good faith as to the application of the law to an issue that had not yet been decided. In addition, my client would have been subjected to unknown and undefined tort damages, allegedly reasonably to flow out of the fact that we didn't pay $160,000 on day one as opposed to 3 or 4 years later by the time the litigation was over. My point, briefly, and I'll try to wrap this up,
thank you,
is that this bill, as written, puts Minnesota on the extreme. And it doesn't just deal with those situations where an insurance company truly does vexatiously, and sometimes maybe it happens, maybe it doesn't. In my experience, I've won more of these cases than I've lost. And in the cases that I've lost, we've gone home at the end of the day, shook hands with our opposition, and congratulated each other for a good fight. In the cases that I've won, the same thing happens between counsel. I wouldn't be surprised if there are circumstances where the policyholder goes home and thinks that I just royally got the shaft stuck to me. But the point is, we should be able to litigate in good faith these types of claims without the prospect of the penalty of paying interest that no one else has to pay, attorney's fees that no one else has to pay, and the type of consequential damages that exist in no other type of breach of contract under Minnesota law. Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. We have some questions up here. Representative David?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was going to ask Mr. Johnson a question, but I already knew what he was going to say. That being said, I do have a series of questions here. I'll be as brief as I can. The first one is for Mr. Marsh. Under Chapter 66, you mentioned that you represent some companies under Chapter 66. Is a company like Spring Valley Mutual in 66 rather than in the other chapter? Because they're not statewide?
Yes. Spring Valley is a 66 company.
So, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Marsh, Spring Valley Mutual Insurance would be covered under this law if it was passed as is.
Correct.
Mr. Marsh?
Correct.
Okay. Now, I remember a few years ago we were sitting in committee and we had several folks, business owners, go get up and testify about how they had to have these claims paid and they had to be paid very quickly. Mr. Atkins, this might, or Mr. Chairman, this might be a question that I'll be asking you here too. And several of the folks who testified, I'm not suggesting that the folks who testified today have anything to do with what I'm about to say, but there were several business owners up saying it had to do with when there was a claim, the insurance company had to pay it within 30 or 60 days, or they had to pay attorney's fees and all this bad stuff that can happen to them. What ended up happening was we had Tom Brace testify, and he said that in arson claims or claims where the business owner actually set their place on fire, those claims would have to be paid, and you know they'd be in Mexico in a few days. What ended up happening, two of the folks that testified before that committee ended up in jail. One of them was from my district, burned down a bowling alley. Another one burned down a newspaper and some things like that. Now, maybe in a little bit here for Representative Atkins, please tell me that we're not going to be forcing claims to be paid quickly so something like that could happen. And I was just wondering to the gentleman, Mr. Stevacek. Okay. Charles. If we go by the American rule, I was wondering, but see, I have a bill up next, and so I have to really cut my comments short and be kind. If that's the American rule, if we pass this, would it be under the un-American rule? but I guess my question is more to the chair when he comes up. I don't want to see companies being forced to pay things that the due diligence hasn't been done to make sure that the claim is valid, because there are some unvalid claims. And I'd also say that I've been in this business 27 years, and never once the hundreds and hundreds of contract holders I have has an insurance company not paid the bill. They would investigate, and then they were legitimate and they were paid. So maybe the folks who testified earlier need a new insurance agent or something. I don't know.
Does someone want to make a quick comment, and maybe Chair Atkins can later? Okay. Okay. Representative Tao?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I want to share my experience with insurance company. I'm more on a personal level. I've always had bad experience whenever something happened. And, you know, the reason why you buy insurance is in case it happens. And so you could pay off whatever happens. And usually I have really bad experience when something happens and the insurance don't want to pay. So I just go get a new insurance agent. Anyway, my question is, there's been statements that says premiums will go up. Can you guys explain to me in layman's terms, why would the premiums go up if this proposal passes? Because if you were paying the legitimate claim, then there shouldn't be issue with this proposal. So why would the premiums go up? Is it because you're going to end up paying more claims, or are you... That's my question. Mr. Johnson?
Well, Mr. Chairman, just briefly, I think what we're trying to summarize here is that the remedies that are in this bill add dollars that are today not paid by the insurance company. So by adding, we call it adding risk or adding more exposure or liability. In other words, this provision that was described as consequential damages, additional money that the insurance company could be required to pay out that today they do not pay out. So insurance companies, the concept is pretty simple in terms of adding up the claim costs. They're going to have to collect enough money to pay whatever the system is requiring them to pay. In House File 417, by adding unlimited attorney's fees and unlimited consequential damages and adding a 12% interest provision that is not there today, there's a prejudgment interest law today that's at 4%. The point is that when you increase the exposure, increase the amount of money that the insurer can be required to pay out, that's going, and as then Mr. Stevak talked about, there are legitimate disputes. So in other words, cases go into the courtroom in our opinion, because they need to be there. It is not clear, or we think the coverage or the claim should not be paid. But the answer to your question is that if you add exposure, add more dollars that the industry is going to have to pay out, it's going to increase the insurance cost. If insurance costs go up, that affects premiums. And I think that's why, you don't have it in front of you, but that's why groups like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the Institute for Legal Reform, the American Tort Reform Association, have analyzed and looked at it, and these are their words, not my words, and they've said, we think this is going to add to the cost of every small and medium business operating in Minnesota. So there are other groups that are agreeing with our assessment that the exposure increases. If the exposure increases, there's a very good chance that the costs are going to go up and the premiums are going to go up.
Representative Tao?
Yes, can you follow up? I guess I'm not in the insurance industry. I figure if the insurance companies are paying all the legitimate claims, you wouldn't have a need to get to even this proposal at all. So my in the ideal world, the insurance company will pay what they promised to pay. And so if they pay what they promised to pay, then we won't get to this bill, I guess. Yeah. And that's where I'm confused as to why, if they're paying everything, then we shouldn't, premiums shouldn't go out.
I can add, I'm sorry.
Stevak?
Stevak.
Okay.
It looked like Stevacek. My father decided that it sounded more Hoosier if I had a two-syllable name than a three-syllable name, so he started saying Stevak.
Thank you, sir. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Representative Powell, I can answer part of what you're asking in two regards. One is this concept of if the insurance companies just pay out the legitimate claims that they should pay. as in any human endeavor, there's going to be differences of opinion of what constitutes legitimate, reasonable, just, or what should be paid. And I've made my career the last 29 years litigating those reasonable disputes between people. Some of them not so reasonable, but in the majority. When I say not so reasonable, I say that I face claims that I thought were outrageous that someone was making them against my insurance client. But the majority of them have been reasonable. And it's the reason why we have courts and why we have juries, because there are going to be periods of time in any human transaction where it's going to require someone to determine whose definition or expectation of reasonable is correct. And I've been doing this for a long time, and my track record is I've won far more cases than I've lost. And so in those circumstances, someone came into that arrangement saying that my insurance company is not being reasonable with me, and the third party, be it the judge, the jury, the Court of Appeals, the Supreme Court, disagreed with them. I've lost cases in situations where obviously my client thought it was taking a reasonable position. Someone disagreed with them. But in neither circumstance has any party been penalized for exercising their right to assert their rights under their contract. Now, where this will increase cost is there are specific instances in this bill where I know that we are going to be litigating like crazy if this thing is passed. For example, the bill allows for the imposition of the penalties, not just for the failure to make claims, but for a delay in making claims. And I guarantee you there will be significant litigation, whole practice groups devoted toward determining what constitutes delay, what's reasonable, what is a reasonable delay, what's not a reasonable delay. The second area is this bill provides for additional remedies beyond those that flow just from the breach of contract. So they provide for additional damages beyond just those that the law has recognized to date flowing from the breach of contract. And there will be severe litigation over what those remedies are. I have practiced in other jurisdictions where this type of additional damage has been allowed, not as liberally as allowed in this statute, but where this type of additional damage has been allowed. And I can tell you from unscientific personal experience that in those situations, the litigation overseeing how much more we can get over the contract ends up being the tail that wags the dog and drives the litigation. So in states, for example, like Montana, so much more extra cost is incurred in litigating these cases because of disputes over what these additional remedies are. So that's one area where the costs are going to go up. I disagree with my esteemed colleague, Tom. This is going to be more litigation, more cases in the courts for longer periods of time.
Thank you, sir. Representative Anderson? I forgot that you asked the question. It's been a little bit.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We've got this fancy list here.
I heard that this will put Minnesota on an island as far as it comes to having this kind of law in place. I'm just curious. I know that there's other states that have instituted some form of this sort of thing. Can you show cases of insurance premiums going up? And also, are they facing a situation where insurance companies just don't want to operate there anymore?
Mr. Johnson?
Well, and Mr. Chairman and Representative Anderson, we can follow back up and submit some of the evidence. There were some characterizations of some of the data that we presented and what it showed or didn't show. Maybe we just give it to you and you can decide what it showed. West Virginia, California, other states that have had a significant expansion in litigation when there's been these additional remedies brought to bear in what we believe is the relevant analogy. And I don't have it here, but I will follow up and submit to you all. You can look at it and judge for yourself whether you think it's, and legislatures and study groups that have looked at some of the expansions of tort law that came about, and they actually, in the California case, the California Supreme Court itself shut down because of the explosion in tort litigation that they experienced in the auto insurance area. And we think those are relevant analogies here. So we have specifics, and we'll get it to you after the hearing.
Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And since someone said that we would be talking about this report, I thought we should hand the report out that the chamber had done one of them. I'm sure there's more. Just quickly, Mr. Spivak, just so that we can get back to the author and some of the other testifiers, What have you seen from a regulatory perspective, what we have on the books now, irregardless of the bad faith, good faith bill we did last year, from the Commerce Department, from the regulatory agencies as to how they're doing, how they're already handling these supposed claims or these, you know, legitimate claims, so that we're not adding another layer of government on top of the two or three layers of government we added last year?
Mr. Stevek?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I can be glad to say that I don't have a lot of experience having to deal with the regulators, being concerned about the conduct of my clients, because in general, my clients seem to be doing the right thing. I know what the regulatory framework is. I know what the impetuses are on us to do the right thing. And I think that in large part, the people who I deal with, and I don't speak on behalf of an industry, I can only speak on behalf of my own personal experience, is that, one, the people I work with do the right thing because it's the right thing to do. Second, they recognize that if they don't, there are sufficient penalties out there already to slap their hands hard enough, that if they need it something other than just it's the right thing to do, it's out there already. So that would be my answer based on my personal experience. The last thing I would say with regard to delay, if there's any group of people that get it hounded into them by their clients to get cases moving and get them resolved, it's insurance companies coming to their defense lawyers and telling them, get this case going. You know, they are no happier paying my bills over an extended period of time than they are paying for copy paper or to have someone take the trash out. I'm an item of expense on their bottom line, and I face constant pressure to keep every case that I have in litigation moving as quickly as I possibly can because they want to shut me off as quickly as they can.
Thank you, Mr. Stevek. Looks like Mr. Johnson has a comment that he might want to make.
Representative Zellers, just briefly, and I would urge you contact Commissioner Wilson in the Commerce Department and ask them. They have detailed logs of who calls in, who complains, who's getting in touch with them. I've asked, and I know what you'll find is that businesses complaining about insurers not paying is not very little that has come into that agency. And so I think you can verify with our agency has a long track record under all administrations of pretty aggressive enforcement of laws and enforcement penalties and a regulatory structure that responds and deals with complaints and problems. And I think you can verify businesses not getting paid is not one of them.
Representative Zellers?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think our next questions are going to be for Chair Atkins or some of the other testifiers.
Looks like Representative Vanzo, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand the need to delay and ultimately, hopefully, on the insurance side, to deny. What I don't understand, and I get really interested when the Chamber of Commerce weighs in on a matter like this, picking and choosing winners and losers, deciding that elongating the litigation in a matter is preferable to settlement, and that the position of the insurance industry is superior to the position of Minnesota businesses that are just looking for relief and looking for justice in the agreement that they have with insurance companies. I think this is far simpler than what it is, the way it is being described here. And I would like Mr. Johnson to tell us, and perhaps Representative Zellers, who's passed out the U.S. Chamber Institute for Legal Reform piece, is the Chamber of Commerce really picking sides in matters such as this, in legislation such as this, around the country? Or not?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, I'm only testifying for my members here tonight. And the document that you're referencing, this is not the Minnesota Chamber, this is the United States Chamber of Commerce, and this is a document that they prepared because they get involved with these discussions and issues, you know, on a 50-state basis.
Is the Minnesota Chamber part of the U.S. Chamber?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know the answer to that. They're here and they can...
Mr. Hesse is about 7 feet away. I don't know if he... Mr. Hesse, please.
Chair and members of the record, my name is Tom Hesse. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And I think as the chair of the committee knows, the Minnesota Chamber has a board meeting to discuss, among other things, this issue tomorrow. So the timing of this hearing is a little unfortunate. We have tried to get both sides of this issue into a conference room over the last several months and discuss to see if there's some sort of common ground that could be reached. As part of that discussion, we did ask the U.S. Chamber Institute for Legal Reform to do an analysis of last year's bill, and that, I believe, is what was distributed. We distributed to the parties that were at our meeting last week, and so we sought that feedback from the U.S. Chamber on this proposal as part of our effort to try to reach some common ground. And so far, we haven't been very successful. We'll have a staff recommendation tomorrow to the board, I'll be happy to come back at some later time and give you the results of the board discussion, but I think it's premature for me to let you know where I think they'll come out.
Representative Manzella, just keep in mind, I have a constituent out in the crowd that's sure. Mr. Suspansky that wants to be heard on Mr. David's bill, so I have an interest in Mr. David's bill.
Very well taken, Mr. Chair.
I don't know what the chairman does anymore.
Are you good, Representative Anzello?
Fine.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hesse. Chair Atkins, I don't know if you want to come forward, and I think there were some questions that Representative Ellers and maybe Representative David's had, and I'm seeing quite a few hands now, Representative Anderson, too. So, Representative Sellers, I don't know if you want.
Sure, I'll be brief, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Chairman. I skipped the rest of them, but the main one, no offense, but why are you here? Last year and 2 years ago, we had the bad faith, good faith, bad faith, depending on which house you're in. Passed, this is going to be the cure-all, the peace in the valley we've been looking for. The industry was going to come together with the trial lawyers, and I understand the trial lawyers aren't technically, in advocating for this bill, but I thought we had the solution, and after 2 years of working on it, I thought maybe you want to take a little time off. You actually go out there and build some work. But, if we had the solution, why are we back for, round two or three or...
Chair Atkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zellers, it's an excellent point, and what I found out was that the bill we passed last year does a great job on behalf of the typical consumer. It does almost nothing for folks like this that are sitting over here, the Angians of the world. I can actually answer your question, Representative David's question, in the same one, because he raised an excellent point about Tom Brace coming in and talking about, there's possible, if there's an arson case, we ought to be able to investigate it and so forth. The bottom line on this bill is that an insurance company can still deny a claim. And if they prevail, like Mr. Spivak, my friend, apparently prevails on all of his cases, there will be no payment of any attorney's fees, no nothing. If the person that bought the coverage should have paid thousands, sometimes tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars for that coverage, if they prevail, then they just get made whole. They don't end up in this huge hole that they otherwise would be in, like the situation that I described if you had a hardware store burned out. That remedy we currently don't have. 22 other states allow prejudgment interest at 10% or more. 21 other states allow fees to be awarded just to make the plaintiff whole. The poor small business person, just put them back in the position they would have been in had they not been dinked around with.
Representative Dellers.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Chairman, and probably shouldn't even bother to ask you this, but if the idea is to get the folks that are owed the money, the small business owners, the folks over here, if it's the idea is to make them whole, then why not limit the attorney's fees?
Chair Atkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dellers, they have to pay those attorney's fees no matter what. Are you talking un-American, like Representative Davis said? The fact is they're having to pay that out no matter what. If you want to cap those, you can propose to cap them, but it's coming out of the Angions of the world. It's coming out of their high. The bottom line for this bill is I'd much rather have them investing in new jobs and new products and moving Minnesota ahead than investing in paying lawyers, even though I'm one.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe we'll have an amendment
tonight or later?
No.
Representative David.
I'll pass. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. Representative Atkins, do you have a fiscal note for this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I don't believe there will be a fiscal consequence to this bill.
Okay.
Other than to the folks involved. But there won't be to the state of Minnesota.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, you know, based on history that we've seen in other states that have instituted some form of this and seeing an increase in the courts, an increase on the court system, you haven't asked for a fiscal note at all? Or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that's not correct. I've got the 50-state analysis that I can show you that demonstrates that there's not. And I would let you, as Mr. Johnson said, take a look at them yourself. There's lots of states that have this. They haven't experienced an explosion in litigation. They haven't experienced an explosion in rates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I would appreciate that. I guess in response to Representative Ansel's comments there, when I look at this issue, I see it as the insurance company certainly doesn't win and the businesses certainly don't win. The only people that are winners out of this is really the attorneys that are involved in the case, because businesses, yeah, they may recoup their losses, but they are also going to see an increase in their insurance premiums. And, you know, so I don't know if this is really a solution to the problem that, you know, people are experiencing. So,
Jack and
Mr. Representative Anderson, with all due respect, the lawyers, Mr. Spivak or Mielenhausen here or whomever, they're already getting paid. This doesn't change it one bit. What it allows for is these nice folks over here that want to invest in medical devices and move Minnesota forward, they get just made whole so they can keep doing that, as opposed to having this huge hole that they were placed into because they got wrongly denied by their insurance company and then had to go through all this litigation cost. So the lawyers don't actually make... In fact, why am I carrying this bill if it doesn't do anything for lawyers? But that's the bottom line, is it doesn't do anything for lawyers.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess one of the things I was wondering is, we're talking about Minnesota companies and large companies and small companies. How widespread is this? Is this something that happens to every business? Does it happen every day? Is it net? Is this a benefit for every company in Minnesota? Is it a bad thing for most companies? I don't know.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe, I can give you, in fact, one thing I noted that nobody else has, but I've got a dozen cases that I can cite you to, significant cases from small companies to large companies. One common instance seems to be that many of the insurance companies are based in Ohio, Massachusetts, Virginia, a variety of other places. I love Ms. Turner and Travelers being located here. They don't seem to be the... involved in these wrongful denials. It seems to be a lot of insurance companies that are based elsewhere. And, you know, I can understand, without trying to be too parochial about it, you got a Minnesota company that's just trying to make ends meet. It's a lot easier to deny them if you're not in the backyard doing business here like the Travelers of the world are.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick follow-up. And again, I don't know the answer to this, and I know for you guys that are lawyers, you always want to know the answer first, but I'm just a curious guy. When we're talking about this, I mean, I don't know how many cases we're talking about, and are we talking about, you know, Murdoch's hardware store in Perm, is he shopping for insurance all over the country, or is he going to somebody local? I mean, for the majority of Minnesota businesses, is this an issue? By the way, he smells a little bit like gasoline for your story earlier. I don't know what's going on.
Chair Representative Hoppe, my response would be that we've got a number of folks in the room that have experienced it. We can reference, and I know some of you have gotten emails from your own constituents that have said they've experienced this. To the extent it happens to one, it's bad. But I've got at least a dozen instances, some of which are claims involving hundreds of millions of dollars, that I'd much rather have them invest that money in, like I said, invest in Minnesota in new development than in legal fees.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Chair Atkins, I see you have a tough journey. You've got to face Maury's committee?
And as much as I hate it, Mr. Chair, I would renew my motion that House File 417 be recommended to pass and referred to the committee on civil justice.
As amended, sir?
As amended. Thank you.
Any questions? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
No.
Motion carries, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative David? Representative David's, please state your name for the record. No, go ahead when you're ready, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move House File 534 be recommended pass and to the General Register. And Mr. Chairman, I do have an amendment. It's the A3 amendment to get the bill in the shape that I would like to present it in.
Thank you, Representative David. It's my understanding, though, it's actually going to go to the Committee on Civil Justice.
Like I said, I would move it to civil
That's
justice.
That's what I thought you said, that it's moved to civil justice. We've got the amendments. All in favor of the amendments, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, the motion carries. Representative David, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Basically what this bill does, it deals with certificates of insurance, and I'm going to turn it over to Dominic Spezzetto, and I'd like the agenda to correct the spelling of his name, which would be S-P-O-S-E-T-O. From the Minnesota Independent Insurance Agent. He'll testify briefly, and then we have a witness here to testify.
Thank you, Representative David. Let me ask, by the way, is there anybody here in opposition to the bill? All right, gentlemen, accordingly.
Mr. Chairman, Dominic Spezzetto, representing the Minnesota Independent Insurance Agents Association, and I'll be very brief. Let you move on to the bill. This bill basically takes several concepts, some from current law, some from common law, some from insurance regulations, and some from basically basic insurance practices, and puts it all in one place in statute. This relates to certificates of insurance. And certificates of insurance are basically pieces of paper that document the facts, the evidence that a person has insurance coverage, the type of coverage, and the fact that that coverage is in force at the date the certificate is originated. This is used quite frequently for third parties who hire someone to do work for them, or a contractor using a subcontractor where they want the proof that that person has insurance to cover the risk that they're going to incur. And it's a very common practice. It's gotten to be so common that it's becoming quite burdensome, and there are a lot of certificates being requested from various parties for almost every purposes. And so what we want to clarify are three things. First of all, that the certificate is nothing more than proof of insurance, that the certificate can't be changed, it can't change the underlying coverages that are in the policy. The policy contract is the document that you're proving is in existence, and there should be nothing in the insurance certificate that actually changes or amends or alters anything in the policy. In fact, that wouldn't hold up in court. And lastly, what we're really doing at the heart of this issue is that we're regulating ourselves. We're going to prohibit insurance agents from amending or altering any of these certificates that would suggest anything contrary to the policy, and we're making it subject of a revocation or suspension of their license if they do so. Mr. Chairman, I'll turn it over to Mr. Szczepanski.
Thank you, Mr. Spezzetto. Mr. Szczepanski, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. It seems like we like to get some long names up here for all of you. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Lilly. Greetings from downtown North St. Paul.
You might want to pull that microphone more towards...
All right. As Dominic stated, the certificate of insurance has been a form that, in the period of time in the three decades that I've been in the insurance business, that has been a form that's been quite easy to use.
but more and more recently, and over the last 5 years and increasingly so, these certificate requests that we get from all these various parties are asking us to change, in by issuing a certificate, changing the form of the policy. What we want to be able to do with this is to have a self-regulating form that it's also something that's simple for us to, if someone's asking us for some of these certificates that the policy doesn't cover or is contrary to state law, that we can attach this to our answer with the certificate saying, here's the certificate we can issue, and here is the state law that says why we can't issue what you're asking for. That's pretty simple of what we'd like to do. It keeps us out of trouble.
That wasn't lost on us, Mr. Skubanski. We appreciate your testimony. Are there any, unless there's questions, the Representative Davids will renew his motion that House File 534, as amended, be recommended, passed, and referred to the Committee on Civil Justice. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, seeing none, that motion carries. Thank you, Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
And gentlemen, thank you very much for taking the time and your patience in coming to testify. Representative Dill is House File 208. I saw him. I think he's around. Of course he did. Well, the chair will move that House File 208 be recommended to pass. Actually, before that, we need the chair will move that House File 208 committee report be adopted. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, seeing none. That brings the bill before the committee. Representative Atkins, the chair, will move that House File 208 be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Civil Justice. Representative Dill, welcome to the committee. Thank you for your testimony. Are there anyone opposed to House File 208? That's my understanding. It's non-controversial. But Representative Dill, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is about sending a notice on a possessory lien on a motor vehicle for a mechanic's lien. The Grand Marais Postmaster brought this to my attention, that the law is currently stated says that the notice to the lien holder and to the owner and the various interested parties needs to be sent by registered mail. Registered mail is not the proper vehicle fund to be used. Registered mail is for like sending your watch to get it repaired, or sending some jewelry somewhere, or sending a signed stock certificate. And it has insurance up to $25,000. It also costs the entry level $13.82 to do it. Registered mail, however, is to send a document that doesn't need the same kind of security and following for $5.72. So the fine postmaster said that whoever made this law put in the wrong type of service. So that's all the bill does, is change it from registered, which is improper, to certified, which is proper, and save the person $8.21 of doing it.
Boy. So, I mean, Representative Dill, I think Representative Davids may have that in his campaign flyer next time. That's good government all the time right there.
Well, I mean, you know, Representative Davids, you can't charge this to your campaign account, though, when you send these.
There.
Well, I tried, so.
We'll just put our head in the sand on that one, yeah.
He and I are very famous at the campaign board.
Is there anyone that is opposed to good government all the time and desires to testify with respect to this bill? Seeing none, the chair will renew his motion that House File 208 be recommended passed and referred to the Committee on Civil Justice. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none. Thank you. That motion carries. Next up is House File 166. Representative Sanders, committee report is coming from the division, so the chair will move that House File 166's committee report be adopted. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, seeing none. Representative Sanders will move that House File 166 be recommended to pass. It's my understanding that you're heading off to the floor with this. Is that, anyone aware of any requests for it? All right, there you go then. Representative Sanders, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill prohibits retailers from knowingly selling a toy that has been recalled for safety reasons by the federal government, manufacturer, the wholesaler, the distributor, or the importer. Minnesota is one of just a handful of states that does not explicitly ban the sale of recalled toys. The practice is banned under federal law, and this House File 166 will just put us in line with that federal law and extend the ability for the Department of Commerce to take action as well on this. stand for any questions, if there are any.
Thank you, Representative Sanders. We've sent a page. There were 11 people that signed up to testify just within the last hour in opposition to your bill, so we sent a page for them. If they're not here momentarily, I guess, are there questions or concerns for Representative Sanders' bill? Representative Zeller?
Mr. Chairman, I heard about that list, and I think the one precursor was a treat for your first bill in front of the Commerce Committee as a freshman member, so maybe if the...
Yeah. Mr. Chair, after it passes.
Representative Sanders?
After it passes.
Oh, smart
play. Boy, it could have trouble. Is there anyone here to testify with respect to House File 166? Otherwise, Representative Sanders renews his motion that House File 166 be recommended pass as amended by the division and adopted in the committee report. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Thank you, Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And with that, folks, we are adjourned. We have no meeting on Thursday.